Imagine handing the IRS half of your investment returns simply because you put, the exact right asset into the exact wrong retirement account.
Oh, yeah, a total nightmare.
Right. Or watching your supposedly safe investment just drop by 20% in a single week.
Just because the Federal Reserve tweaked a single interest rate? It happens all the time.
It really does. But before we jump in, this deep dive is brought to you by Cert Fuel. They've got a full Series 66 course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams weighted just like the real thing.
Yeah, super helpful stuff.
Really is. Check it out at certfuel.com. Keep it casual, keep it quick, and let's get into it.
Let's do it.
All right, welcome back. Today, we are taking a massive deep dive into the Series 66 fixed income section. And, if you are studying for this exam right now, you already know this material is just an absolute
Oh,
beast.
completely. It's a beast.
It's dense, it's super counterintuitive, and honestly, it feels like a completely different language compared to the equity side of the market.
It is a different language, primarily because the Series 66 doesn't just want to know if you can memorize a flashcard definition of a bond.
Right. They don't care if you just know the word.
Exactly. The exam tests the mechanics, it tests the actual application.
Yeah.
You can't just know what a bond is, you have to understand how that bond behaves when the world around it changes.
Which is the tricky part.
It really is. So our goal today is to deeply learn, retain, and actually apply these bond valuation factors. We want you to be able to see a scenario on the test and instantly know what's happening beneath the surface.
Which means we are focusing heavily on the why, like why things happen. If you only memorize the what, a tricky exam question will completely derail you.
Oh, they'll trap you in a second.
They really will. But if you understand the underlying logic,
Foundation.
yeah, exactly. If you know why a bond is reacting a certain way, you can puzzle out the answer to a scenario you've never even seen before.
That's the secret to passing.
It is. And to keep us grounded today, to bring these incredibly dry concepts to life, we are going to use a cast of characters. So, listener, I want you to picture three specific investors in your mind.
Having a narrative really helps cement the mechanics for me, honestly. Who is our first investor?
So, first, we have high bracket Helen. Helen is wealthy, she is highly successful, and she hates taxes more than anything else on the planet.
I know a few Helens.
We all do, right?
Yeah.
Her entire investment philosophy, her whole worldview, is driven by keeping her money out of the hands of the IRS. She doesn't care about bragging rights at the country club.
No, she only cares about her after-tax yield,
Exactly, the cash in her pocket.
which is a very standard client profile in wealth management, by the way. People will bend over backward to shield their income.
Right. So that's Helen. Next up, we have Desperate Dan. Dan is, let's call it chaotic.
Chaotic is a good word for Dan.
Yeah, he always needs his cash immediately. He has zero patience, and he actively seeks out investments in highly risky, like borderline bankrupt companies.
Just chasing that massive lottery ticket payout.
Exactly. Dan lives entirely on the edge.
The quintessential high yield, high liquidity risk taker. He wants massive returns and he wants the ability to bail out at a moment's notice.
Yep, that's our guy Dan. And finally, rounding up the trio, we have cautious Carl. Carl is terrified of risk.
Terrified.
He is terrified of interest rate changes. He loses sleep over tiny price swings. Carl just wants predictability and safety.
And if his portfolio drops by a fraction of a percentage point, he is calling you at 2 in the morning in a total panic.
100%. So we have the tax avoider, the risk taker, and the risk avoider.
That pretty much covers the primary motivations driving the entire fixed income market beautifully.
Awesome. So let's dive into the actual mechanics, starting with high bracket Helen and the tax game. Because, to value a bond, to know if it's actually worth buying, you first have to know how much of its return the government is going to siphon off.
Right, because the gross yield is basically just a vanity metric if you're losing almost half of it to federal and state taxes.
Exactly. So what's the tax treatment look like?
Well, that is the foundation of bond selection for high net worth individuals. The after-tax yield is the only number that actually matters. And the tax code treats different types of bonds very, very differently.
Okay, break that down for us.
We generally break this down into three main categories of issuers. So you've got corporations, the federal government, and municipalities.
Let's start with the corporations. When a company like, say, Apple or Ford issues a corporate bond, what is the tax treatment for the investor?
Corporate bonds are fully taxable at all levels.
Just zero shelter.
Absolutely no shelter here. You pay federal income tax, you pay state income tax, and if you live in a city with a local income tax, you pay that too.
Ouch.
Yeah. When a corporation issues debt, The government treats it as standard income and wants its full cut.
Okay, so Helen is going to avoid corporate bonds like the plague, unless they are paying some astronomical yield to make up for that tax hit.
Right.
Let's look at the second category, which is U.S. Treasuries. These are issued by the federal government.
Right, so U.S. Treasuries split the difference. Kind of. They are exempt from state and local taxes, but the federal government still taxes the interest.
Okay, why is that?
The underlying logic here goes back to constitutional sovereignty, actually. The states are generally not permitted to tax the federal government's obligations because, you know, the power to tax involves the power to destroy.
Makes sense.
But the federal government isn't going to let you off the hook for federal taxes just because you bought their debt. They still want their money.
Right. They're not that generous. So state and local exempt, but federal taxable. That's better for Helen, definitely, but it's not perfect. Which brings us to the third category.
The one she loves.
The one where high bracket Helen gets incredibly excited. Municipal bonds or munis. These are issued by states, cities, counties, or local agencies, right?
Yeah. Municipal bonds are the golden goose for someone like Helen.
Oh, yeah.
The interest paid on municipal bonds is generally exempt from federal income tax.
Wow, really?
Yeah. The federal government essentially subsidizes local infrastructure, so things like public schools, highways, water treatment plants, by telling investors, hey, if you lend your money to the local government to build this bridge, we won't tax the interest you earn.
Okay, and this creates a totally fascinating scenario for someone trying to optimize their taxes. Let's look at the ultimate setup for Helen, which is the triple tax exempt scenario.
Oh, this is the holy grail.
Let's say Helen lives in New York City. She pays high federal taxes, high New York State taxes, and high New York City local taxes. If Helen buys a municipal bond issued by the state of Texas, what happens?
Okay, so if she buys a Texas muni, the interest is federally tax-free.
Great.
However, because she lives in New York and bought an out-of-state bond, New York State and New York City are going to tax that interest.
Okay.
Yeah, states only give you a tax break if you buy their bonds. They don't care about subsidizing a highway in Texas.
Right, they want you to fund their stuff.
Yes.
So listener, direct question for you. If you're taking the Series 66 and you get a question about a client buying an in-state municipal bond, let's logically deduce this.
Let's do it.
Helen lives in New York. She buys a New York muni. Okay. The federal government doesn't tax it. And because she bought it in her home state, New York doesn't tax it either. Who gets to tax her interest income?
Nobody.
Nobody. The result is triple tax exempt. Federal, state, and local are all zero.
And for someone in the highest tax brackets, avoiding 30, 40, or even 50% in combined taxes is a massive windfall.
What, huge?
Like, if Helen buys a corporate bond yielding 5% after taxes, she might only keep 2.5%. But if she buys a New York municipal bond yielding 3%, she keeps the entire 3%.
So the muni actually puts more cash in her pocket, even though the headline yield is technically lower. Okay, but listen up. Red alert. If I were writing the exam, this is exactly where I would try to trick someone up. I would try to trick the test taker into thinking that everything about a municipal bond is tax-free forever.
Which is a trap.
That is a massive trap. Tell them why.
It is perhaps the most common trap on this section of the exam. The tax exemption on municipal bonds applies exclusively to the interest income.
The interest. Just the interest.
Just the interest. The coupon payments you receive twice a year are tax exempt.
Yeah.
It does not, under any circumstances, apply to capital gains.
Okay, let's put some numbers to that to make it super concrete. So Helen buys that New York municipal bond in the secondary market for $900. It's a discount bond.
Oh, yeah.
A year later, she sells it to another investor for $1,000. She just made a $100 profit. That is a capital gain. The IRS is absolutely going to tax that $100 capital gain run.
Without question, you have to intellectually separate the income stream from the price appreciation of the underlying asset.
So interest is protected, but the capital gain is exposed.
Exactly. If you forget that distinction, you will definitely lose points on the exam.
Okay, so Helen understands the taxation of the bond itself, but now we have to talk about account placement. Where should Helen physically hold this municipal bond? Because as we just established, a muni bond yields less than a corporate bond right out of the gate.
Right, because the market is smart. The tax exemption's already priced in.
Exactly.
The market is highly efficient. If investors know a bond is tax-free, they will bid the price up, which drives the yield down. You are literally paying for the tax shelter by accepting a lower yield up front.
So let's look at an absurd scenario. Helen gets confused. She takes her low-yielding municipal bond, and she decides to put it inside her traditional IRA.
Oh, no.
Let's walk through the mechanics of this total disaster. Listener, I want you to think about this. What happens if she puts a muni in a tax-sheltered account?
She ruins everything. It is a complete financial disaster.
What?
To understand why, you have to look at the rules of a traditional IRA. A traditional IRA is tax-deferred. You put pre-tax money in, it grows tax-deferred. But the absolute unbreakable rule of that account is that every single dollar you withdraw in retirement is taxed as ordinary income.
Wow. Okay, so if she puts a tax-free muni bond inside a traditional IRA, the tax-free interest goes into the account. But the account doesn't care where the money came from.
Well,
when she reaches retirement and pulls that money out to pay for groceries,
it gets painted as ordinary income and taxed at her highest marginal rate.
That is wild.
She literally took a tax-free bond, accepted a terrible yield to get that tax-free status, and then locked it in a box that magically transforms tax-free money into fully taxable money.
She gets the worst of both worlds. Lower yield, high taxes.
Exactly.
That is painfully funny. It's like buying a waterproof jacket and then wearing it under your clothes while you stand in the rain.
That's a perfect analogy.
But what about putting a muni in a Roth IRA? Or like her favorite charities account?
It's equally flawed, just in a slightly different way. A Roth IRA, or a qualifying charity account, already pays zero taxes on investment income.
Right.
So if Helen puts a muni in a Roth, she's accepting a lower yield, say 3% instead of 5%, to avoid a tax that the Roth IRA was already going to let her avoid anyway.
So she gave up 2% of yield for literally zero additional benefit.
Yes. So the golden rule to burn into your brain for the exam. Municipal bonds belong in a taxable account owned by an investor in a high marginal tax bracket.
Okay, listener, hear that again. If you see a question asking about placing a muni in any kind of retirement account, pension plan, or tax-exempt account, the answer is always that it is an unsuitable recommendation.
Correct. Account placement is just as important as asset selection.
Got it. Okay, let's leave Helen and her tax anxiety behind for a minute and shift our focus to our next character, Disparate Dan.
Bring in Dan.
Dan doesn't care about taxes because he's usually losing money anyway, frankly. Dan is worried about two things. Getting his money back fast if he needs to bail, and making sure he gets paid if the risky companies he invests in go belly up.
Which brings us to liquidity and liquidation priority.
Right. Let's start with liquidity.
Liquidity is a concept that is often misunderstood, I think. People think it just means, can I sell this? But true liquidity is a measure of how fast you can sell an asset without tanking its price.
Okay, so it's about the depth of the market and the bid-ask spread.
Exactly.
I like to use real estate as the classic illiquid example. If you own a house, you can't just sell it at 2 p.m. on a Tuesday for its full fair market value.
No, absolutely not.
If you need the cash in 1 hour, you're going to have to sell that house for a massive discount to find a buyer willing to move that fast.
Right, you take a huge haircut.
But a share of Apple stock, you can sell that in a millisecond at the exact quoted market price. Bonds exist on a vast spectrum between those two extremes.
And the fundamental rule of fixed income applies here. The market demands a premium for taking on risk or inconvenience.
And illiquidity is a major inconvenience.
Therefore, less liquid bonds must offer higher yields to convince investors to buy them.
Makes perfect sense. Let's map out this liquidity hierarchy. We need to rank these from most liquid to least liquid because the exam expects you to know where these fit relative to one another.
Okay.
At the very top, the undisputed king of liquidity, U.S. Treasuries.
The U.S. Treasury market is the most liquid financial market in the world. There is massive daily trading volume. Billions of dollars change hands effortlessly.
It's like selling bottled water in a desert. Everyone wants it, the price is universally understood, and you can always find a buyer instantly.
Very true.
Right below treasuries, we have agency bonds. Things like mortgage-backed securities from Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac.
They are highly liquid, backed implicitly or explicitly by the government, but they are just a tiny step down from pure U.S. treasuries in terms of sheer trading volume and ease of transaction.
Next down the ladder, moving into the private sector, we have investment-grade corporate bonds. These are bonds issued by massive, stable companies, Microsoft, Johnson & Johnson.
These are reasonably liquid, especially for large, newly issued bonds. Institutional investors trade them constantly, so you can usually find a buyer without taking a significant haircut on the price.
But then the liquidity drops off a cliff.
It really does.
Next down are municipal bonds. Remember Helen's munis? You might think they are super safe, so they must be liquid. but they actually trade incredibly infrequently.
The issue with the municipal bond market is that it is highly fragmented. There are tens of thousands of different local issuers.
Right, it's not just one big entity.
Exactly. A bond issued by a tiny school district in rural Ohio might not trade for weeks or even months at a time. If you need to sell it on a Tuesday, you might have a very hard time finding a buyer who even knows what that specific bond is, let alone one willing to pay a fair price for it.
Okay, and finally, at the very bottom of the liquidity barrel, we find the stuff Desperate Dan loves: high yield or junk corporate bonds.
Oh yeah, these are highly illiquid. Wide bid-ask spreads, very few buyers, and massive price volatility.
Trying to sell a junk bond during a market panic is literally like trying to sell a used stained mattress on Craigslist.
That's a gross image, but incredibly accurate.
You might find a buyer eventually, but you are gonna have to slash your asking price to practically nothing to get rid of it. You are trapped.
Which is why Dan demands a massive yield to hold those bonds. He is being compensated for the risk that he might be stuck with the mattress.
Okay, so that covers how fast Dan can sell. But what if he holds the bond and the inevitable happens? His favorite highly leveraged, risky company actually goes bankrupt.
The nightmare scenario.
Right. The company's being liquidated by a bankruptcy court.
Yeah.
The corporate pie is being sliced up and handed out. Who eats first?
This is known as liquidation priority, or the absolute priority rule. When a company is liquidated, there is a rigid legal hierarchy of who gets paid from the remaining assets.
And what's the foundational rule here?
The foundational rule is that debt always, always comes before equity. Owners get paid last, lenders get paid first.
Okay, so at the very front of the line, holding the biggest plates, are secured bonds. These are backed by physical collateral.
If a major airline goes bankrupt, the secured bondholders literally have a legal claim to the airplanes, the spare parts, or the real estate.
They can just take the planes.
Basically,
Yeah.
the court will sell those specific assets and give the money directly to the secured bondholders. They eat first.
Next in line are the unsecured bonds. They don't have a claim on a specific airplane or a specific building. They just have a general claim on whatever corporate assets are left over after the secured guys take their collateral.
And this is where the exam loves to play vocabulary games.
Yes. Listener, pay attention here.
No.
If I'm writing this test, I am definitely going to use the word debenture to try and trick you. Debenture. When you say it out loud, it sounds incredibly fancy. It sounds secure.
Yes, my wealth is safely stored in debentures.
Exactly. It sounds like something kept in a vault.
It carries a lot of prestige in its tone, but in reality, a debenture is strictly unsecured debt. It is backed by nothing but the issuer's good faith and credit.
Which is just a fancy way of saying a promise to pay.
A handshake and a signature.
Do not let the fancy name fool you. If the exam asks where a debenture sits in liquidation, it is unsecured. It sits behind the secured bonds. It is just a formalized IOU.
Exactly.
So what comes after the debentures?
Following the standard debentures, you have subordinated debentures. The word subordinated literally means lower in rank.
Right. They agreed to step back.
These lenders agreed, when they got the bond, to stand further back in line. They get whatever is left after the regular unsecured debentures are made whole.
And then finally, after all the lenders have scrounged whatever they can, we get to the equity, the actual owners of the company.
Within equity, preferred stock comes first. They have preference in liquidation over common shareholders. At the absolute bottom of the barrel, getting the microscopic crumbs, if there are any left, which in a true bankruptcy there almost never are, is the common stock.
So the mental order to memorize: secured debt, unsecured debt, which are debentures, subordinated debt, preferred stock, common stock. That is the hierarchy of survival.
And Dan, buying high-yield junk bonds is usually sitting in that unsecured or subordinated tier, sweating bullets while the bankruptcy lawyers carve up the company.
It's a stressful life for Dan.
Very.
Let's pivot from the chaos of bankruptcy to a completely different kind of risk. What happens when a company is doing well? What if they don't go bankrupt, but the broader economy changes? Let's bring in cautious Carl.
Poor Carl.
Right, Carl bought a high-quality bond because he wants safety. He found a nice, stable corporate bond paying 6% interest. He thinks he's locked that in for the next 10 years. But bonds often have something called a call feature.
Not all bonds, but a significant portion of corporate and municipal bonds are callable. This feature is written into the bond's indenture, its rulebook.
And what does it do?
It gives the issuer the right, but critically, not the obligation, to redeem the bond, essentially buying it back from the investor before the maturity date.
To understand why a company would do this, you have to look at it from their perspective. The best analogy here is refinancing a home mortgage.
Oh, that's a great way to think about it.
If I buy a house and get a mortgage at 7%, I'm thrilled to have the house. But if 2 years later, the economy shifts and mortgage rates drop to 4%, what am I going to do?
You are going to refinance. You will take out a new loan at 4% and use that cash to immediately pay off the expensive 7% loan.
Yeah.
You just saved yourself a fortune in interest payments.
Right. Corporate issuers do the exact same thing to investors.
They do.
If a corporation issues bonds to Carl paying 6% and then market interest rates drop to 4%, the corporation's CFO looks at the balance sheet and realizes they are overpaying for their debt.
Precisely. So, listener, direct question. Interest rates drop from 6% to 4%. What does the issuer do to cautious Carl's 6% bond?
They call it away from him.
Exactly. They will exercise the call feature. They will call the bond back, hand Carl his principal, and then issue brand new bonds to the public at the new, cheaper 4% rate.
So Carl is sitting at home, happy with his 6% yield. Interest rates in the broader economy drop from 6 to 4. The issuer exercises the call. Carl opens his mail and finds a check for his principal. His bond is just gone.
Gone.
This introduces a double whammy of risk for our friend Carl. Call risk and reinvestment risk.
They're two sides of the same terrible coin for the investor.
Let's walk through Carl's exact problem here. He just got his cash back. He didn't want his cash back. He wanted his 6% yield.
But he has to put it somewhere.
Right. He can't just stick the money under his mattress, so he has to go back into the bond market to invest it. What is the problem he immediately faces?
The problem is the current market environment. Why was his bond called in the first place? Because interest rates dropped to 4%. So Carl takes his cash, looks for a new, equally safe bond, and finds that the best he can do is 4%. He is forced to reinvest his money into a market that is now paying significantly less than what he was earning yesterday. That is the definition of reinvestment risk.
It's brutal. Because this risk is so prevalent and because the issuer has this massive structural advantage, the market demands a compromise. Callable bonds have to offer a higher yield up front than non-callable bonds.
They have to.
Like if a non-callable bond yields 5%, a callable bond of the exact same credit quality might have to yield 5.5% just to convince people like Carl to buy it and take on that target on their back.
That is the essential trade-off.
Yeah.
You accept a slightly higher yield initially, but you live with the constant threat that your asset will be confiscated if the market moves in your favor.
Which brings us to a concept that sounds absolutely terrifying on the exam, but is actually deeply intuitive if you visualize it properly. We are talking about negative convexity.
It sounds like an advanced calculus concept or a term from astrophysics.
It really does. It sounds like what happens right before a star collapses into a black hole. But let's break it down using a slightly absurd analogy.
Okay, I'm ready.
I want you to imagine you are jumping on a trampoline. Normally, bond prices and interest rates act like a seesaw. Rates go down, bond prices go up.
Right.
So if rates are dropping, you are jumping on the trampoline, and every time rates drop, you bounce higher and higher. Your bond's price is skyrocketing.
That inverse relationship is the fundamental law of fixed income. As new bonds are issued with lower yields, your existing bond with a higher yield becomes more attractive, so its price rises.
But imagine jumping on a trampoline in a room with a very low ceiling.
Ouch.
As rates fall, a normal non-callable bond's price rises higher and higher into the open sky. But for a callable bond, that room has a ceiling. As rates drop, the price rises, you bounce higher, and then B-O-N-K.
You hit the ceiling.
You hit the ceiling and you stop rising. You literally cannot go any higher, no matter how hard you jump.
And in this analogy, that ceiling is the bond's call price.
Let's explain the mechanics of why that ceiling exists. Say a bond has a par value of $1,000, and the contract says the issuer has the right to call it at $1,050.
Okay.
If interest rates absolutely plummet to zero, mathematically, the cash flows of that bond might make it intrinsically worth $1,200. But think about the market reality.
The market is highly rational. No investor in their right mind is going to pay you $1,200 today for a bond that the issuer is almost certainly going to forcefully buy back for $1,050 tomorrow.
Exactly.
The moment you pay $1,200, the call is announced, you receive $1,050, and you instantly lose $130.
So the market refuses to bid the price up any further. The price appreciation stops. it flattens out right around that call price. That flattening, that artificial ceiling on your profits, is negative convexity.
It curves the wrong way for the investor. Instead of accelerating upward, the price gain decelerates and flatlines.
Now, listener, if I'm writing the Series 66, here's the trap I set for you. I will ask you when negative convexity occurs. It does not happen all the time. Negative convexity only kicks in when interest rates fall far enough that a call becomes likely.
That is a crucial distinction. It is a highly rate-dependent phenomenon.
If interest rates are currently high, say 8%, and Carl's bond pays 6%, the issuer isn't going to call it. Why would they borrow at 8% to pay off a 6% loan?
They wouldn't.
So in that environment, the bond acts like a completely normal bond. You're jumping on a trampoline outside in a field with no ceiling. It's only when rates drop significantly, approaching the coupon rate, that the room suddenly appears and the ceiling stops your price from rising.
The threat of the call is what generates the negative convexity. No threat, no convexity issue.
Okay, let's stick with cautious Carl because he is having a rough time. He is exhausted by reinvestment risk. He hated that his bond got called. He hated finding a new place to put his money at a lower rate. And quite frankly, he just wants to buy something and ignore it for a decade.
He's done.
He tells you, his financial advisor, I want a bond where I never have to reinvest a single coupon. I don't want to deal with it.
In that case, the only suitable recommendation for Carl is a zero coupon bond.
Let's contrast them clearly. A standard coupon bond pays regular interest, usually twice a year, little steady drips of cash. A zero coupon bond, as the name implies, pays absolutely zero interest along the way. You get nothing until the exact day the bond matures.
The mechanism of return is entirely different. You don't receive interest checks. Instead, you buy the bond at a steep discount to its face value.
My favorite way to visualize this is the financial piñata.
The piñata.
Yeah, think about it. When you buy a regular bond for $1,000, it's like a slot machine that spits out a little handful of candy's interest payments every 6 months. But a zero coupon bond, it's a piñata. You buy it at a massive deep discount. Maybe you only pay $600 for a bond with a $1,000 par value.
Okay, I see where this is going.
You take that piñata, you hang it from the ceiling, and you get nothing, not a single candy. You just stare at it for 10 solid years. And then on the maturity date, you grab a bat, you smash the pinata open, and the full $1,000 falls out all at once.
The difference between the $600 you paid on day one and the $1,000 you receive on year 10 is your interest. It's just entirely deferred and paid as a lump sum at the very end.
And because there are no little candies dropping out along the way, there is nothing for Carl to reinvest. Zero coupons equals zero reinvestment risk. He never has to worry about finding a new place to invest a $30 interest payment in a low-rate environment. He just waits.
It solves his primary anxiety perfectly. But, you know, in finance, solving one risk usually means amplifying another.
Of course it does.
By eliminating reinvestment risk, Carl has inadvertently maximized a different, arguably more dangerous risk. And that risk is measured by a concept called duration.
Oh boy, duration. Listener, pay attention. This is the heavy hitter on the exam. It confuses almost everyone. Let's define it clearly before we explain the mechanics. Duration is a measure of a bond's price sensitivity to interest rate changes. And critically, it is expressed in years, not percentages.
Simply put, it tells you how violently a bond's price will swing when interest rates move in the broader economy. It's a risk multiplier.
Give us an example.
For example, if a bond has a duration of 5 years, its price will change by approximately 5%. For every 1% change in interest rates. If rates go up 1%, the bond drops 5%.
Now, if I'm taking the exam, the most tempting trap is to look at the word years and assume that duration and maturity are the exact same thing. They both measure years, so a 10-year bond has a 10-year duration, right?
That is the exact trap the examiners are setting. They are related concepts, but they measure fundamentally different things. Maturity is simply a calendar date. It's the expiration date printed on the bond. Duration is a complex mathematical measure of risk based on the timing of cash flows.
Here is the golden rule you absolutely have to memorize. It is non-negotiable. Duration equals maturity only for zero coupon bonds.
Let's explore the mechanics of why that is true, because understanding the mechanism makes memorizing the rule unnecessary.
Duration is basically asking a conceptual question. On average, considering all the money this bond pays me, how long do I have to wait to get my total return back?
Exactly. It's a weighted average of the time you spend waiting for every single dollar of cash flow.
So think about the financial piñata, the zero coupon bond. If you buy a 10-year zero coupon bond, when do you get your money? You get zero in year one, zero in year two. You get every single penny in year 10.
Right.
So the average time you wait for your money is exactly 10 years. Therefore, for a zero coupon bond, duration perfectly equals maturity.
But now apply that logic to a standard 10-year coupon bond.
Right. If I buy a 10-year coupon bond, I don't wait 10 years for everything. I get some money back in month 6. I get more money back in month 12, month 18, month 24.
You're getting cash early.
Because I am receiving pieces of my return early, the mathematical average time I wait to get my money back is pulled forward. It is less than 10 years. Those early cash flows act like a counterweight, pulling the average down. So for any bond that pays a coupon, duration is always less than its stated maturity.
That is the perfect way to visualize it. The earlier you get cash back into your hands, the lower the duration. Higher coupon rates mean more cash is paid early, which pushes the duration down even further. Longer maturities mean you have to wait longer for the massive principal repayment at the end, which pushes duration up.
So let's look at the tragic irony of cautious Carl. Carl wanted safety, so he bought a 20-year zero-coupon bond to completely avoid reinvestment risk. Because it is a zero-coupon bond, its duration is a full 20 years.
Which is huge.
That is the highest possible duration for any 20-year investment. Meaning, if the Federal Reserve raises interest rates by 1%, Carl's bond is going to drop by approximately 20% in value. He bought the most volatile, price-swinging instrument available on the market.
He traded reinvestment risk for massive interest rate risk. He locked his money away for 2 decades and ensured his portfolio value would look like a roller coaster. There is truly no free lunch in fixed income.
All right, pattern interrupt. Shake it out. Refocus. If you have zoned out or you are doing the dishes while listening to this, come back to me.
Listen up.
Listener, if you only retain one single concept for the exam today, it has to be this next section. We are talking about the yield seesaw. This is the most heavily tested mechanical concept in the entire fixed income unit.
We need to build a mental framework for how different yield measures relate to each other when a bond's price moves away from its $1,000 par value, because prices are constantly moving.
Because interest rates swing thanks to duration. Bond prices are always floating above or below their par value. We need to define two major yield measures before we map them out on the seesaw. The first is current yield.
Current yield is a very simple math equation. It is the annual coupon payment divided by the current market price.
It is a snapshot. It only measures the income return you are getting right this second. It completely ignores time, it ignores the maturity date, and it completely ignores whether you are going to take a capital gain or a capital loss when the bond eventually matures.
It just asks, based on the exact dollar amount I paid today, what percentage am I getting handed back in cash this year?
Right. It's useful, but incomplete. Which brings us to the heavy hitter, yield to maturity, or YTM. This is the most comprehensive yield measure in finance.
YTM assumes you buy the bond today. You hold it all the way to the final maturity date, and, crucially, you reinvest every single coupon payment you receive at that exact same YTM rate.
It captures the entire picture. It calculates the income, it calculates the complex time value of money, and it factors in the guaranteed capital gain or capital loss you will experience when the bond matures and pays you back exactly $1,000, regardless of what you paid for it.
So how do these measures relate to the coupon rate? We need to construct the hierarchy.
I want you to visualize a physical seesaw on a playground. Right in the exact center, the pivot point of the fulcrum, is the coupon rate. The coupon rate is bolted to the metal. It never, ever moves. If a bond is issued with a 5% coupon, it pays $50 a year. Period.
Period.
The price of the bond and the other yield measures tilt up and down around that fixed, unmoving center point.
Let's start by looking at a discount bond. This is a bond currently trading in the open market for less than its par value, let's say $900.
Okay, if we map the hierarchy for a discount bond from lowest to highest, it looks like this. Coupon rate is the lowest, then current yield is higher, and yield to maturity sits at the very highest point. Let's explain the mechanics of why. Why is current yield higher than the fixed coupon rate?
Because you bought the bond on sale. You only paid $900 out of pocket, but you were still legally entitled to the exact same fixed $50 coupon that the original investor who paid $1,000 gets. Since your initial investment is much smaller, that $50 represents a significantly larger percentage return on your specific purchase price. Your cash-on-cash return is higher.
Exactly. So current yield goes up. But why is yield to maturity even higher than the current yield?
Because of the built-in guaranteed bonus at the end of the bond's life. You only paid $900 today. Every year, you collect your $50 in interest. And then at maturity, the issuer doesn't hand you $900 back. They hand you the full $1,000 par value.
Nice.
You make an automatic $100 capital gain simply by waiting. YTM factors in that massive gain, pushing your total annualized return up to the highest spot on the ladder.
Finance professionals call that the pull to par. As a discount bond approaches its maturity date, its price slowly gets pulled upward until it hits exactly $1,000. Now, let's look at the exact opposite scenario, a premium bond.
This is a bond trading above par. Let's say it costs $1,100 in the open market.
The seesaw completely flips. The hierarchy reverses. For a premium bond, coupon rate is now the highest, current yield is lower, and yield to maturity is the absolute lowest. Walk me through why.
Because you overpaid. You paid $1,100 just to get the right to receive that same fixed $50 coupon. That $50 is now a much smaller percentage of your highly expensive $1,100 purchase price. So the current yield drops below the coupon rate.
And yield to maturity sits at the very bottom because the pull to par is now a penalty, not a bonus. You paid $1,100 out of pocket today. You collect your interest for a few years. But at maturity, the issuer doesn't care what you paid. They only owe you par.
Right. They hand you $1,000.
You take a mathematically guaranteed $100 capital loss at the end. YTM forces you to deduct that painful loss from your annualized return, dragging the yield down to the bottom.
It's just brutal math.
Let's test this logic. Direct question for you, listener. Let's say you buy a bond the market for $1,050. You hold it to maturity. What is the lowest yield measure of the three? Think about the math of what happens at the end.
Think about it.
It's yield to maturity. Because you are taking a guaranteed $50 loss when the bond matures at $1,000. The hierarchy for a premium bond is coupon at the top, then current yield, then YTM sitting at the bottom holding the loss.
We should briefly address one more measure, though. Yield to call, or YTC. Where does it fit on the seesaw?
This one is a bit of a wild card. For a premium callable bond, yield to call is generally the lowest of all the measures, lower even than YTM. Think about the math. If you pay $1,100 and the issuer calls it away from you next year at $1,020, you take a massive capital loss very, very quickly. You don't get 10 years of interest to soften the blow. Your annualized return absolutely plummets.
But we have to emphasize that YTC isn't locked into a fixed invariable order like the other three. The specific call terms, the exact date it can be called, and the exact price it can be called at can vary wildly from bond to bond.
So what's the strategy for the test?
So while it is usually the lowest for a premium bond, the Series 66 examiners might concoct a weird edge case scenario. My advice: stick to the rigid seesaw for coupon, current yield, and YTM, and treat YTC as the dangerous wild card that usually sits at the very bottom for premiums.
Brilliant. All right, moving on from Carl's safe but complicated yields, let's bring back Desperate Dan. Dan is getting bored of regular bonds. He likes the safety of debt. He likes being high up in the liquidation priority if the company goes bankrupt. But his greed is taking over. He wants the massive, uncapped upside of the stock market.
He wants to have his cake and eat it, too.
Exactly.
Dan is looking for a convertible bond. These are unique corporate bonds that give the investor the right to exchange the bond for a fixed, predetermined number of shares of the company's common stock.
It's a bond that can literally shapeshift into equity. You start as a lender, and you can instantly transform into an owner. And there is very specific math you have to know for the exam to understand how these work. Let's walk through it slowly.
Yeah.
The first formula you must know is the conversion ratio. This tells you exactly how many shares of stock you get if you decide to pull the trigger and convert.
The formula for the conversion ratio is the bond's par value divided by the conversion price. The conversion price is set in the bond's contract when it's first issued.
Notice a critical detail there, listener. It is always par value. It absolutely does not matter what the bond is currently trading at in the secondary market. You could have paid $800 or $1,200 for the bond. The contract math is strictly anchored to the $1,000 par. Why is that?
Because the issuer is converting their liability. They owe you $1,000 at maturity. When you convert, they are essentially saying, instead of paying you back the $1,000 we owe you, we will give you stock worth that amount based on the agreed upon conversion price.
So the secondary market price is completely irrelevant to the corporate balance sheet.
Completely irrelevant.
So if the exam gives you a scenario where the conversion price is set at $25.
You take the $1,000 par value divided by the $25 conversion price, and that gives you exactly 40 shares.
So one bond magically turns into 40 shares of stock. Now the second formula, conversion value. Sometimes this is called parity on the exam. This formula tells you what the bond is theoretically worth as stock at today's current market prices.
The formula for conversion value is the conversion ratio we just calculated, multiplied by the current stock price in the open market.
Let's continue Dan's example to see how he tries to game the system. We know his ratio gives him 40 shares. He opens his brokerage app and sees that the company's common stock is currently trading at $30 a share. What is his conversion value?
40 shares times $30.
Which equals $1,200. His bond, if he magically shapeshifted it into stock right this second, is worth $1,200.
Now comes the critical decision rule, the moment of truth. Should Dan convert the bond?
Let's logic this out. Dan looks at the bond market. His bond is currently trading as debt for $1,100. But his conversion value, the stock value, is $1,200. If I am Dan, what is my immediate action?
You gotta take the money.
I convert it, absolutely. I take an asset that the bond market says is worth $1,100. I push a button and it transforms into stock worth $1,200. I just manufactured $100 of pure value out of thin air.
The decision rule is incredibly simple. Convert when the conversion value is mathematically greater than the bond's market price.
What if it's not?
If the stock had tanked and was only trading at $20 a share, his conversion value would be $800. He would never, ever trade an $1,100 bond for $800 of stock. He would just ignore the conversion feature and continue holding the bond for its interest payments.
It's basically a built-in stock option strapped to a bond. Dan loves it. But how do we know if Dan's convertible bond, or any bond for that matter, is actually going to pay out? That brings us to grading the risk. We need to evaluate default risk by looking at credit ratings and credit spreads.
Credit ratings are essentially a standardized report card for a company's financial health. There are two main grading agencies you need to recognize for the exam, Moody's and Standard & Poor's, often called S&P. They serve the same purpose, but they use slightly different grading scales.
The most critical thing to know here, the thing they will test you on, is the investment grade line. The exact cutoff point that separates the safe, institutional quality bonds from the high yield junk that Dan loves. You must memorize this specific cutoff.
Let's start with Standard & Poor's, and Fitch uses the same scale. It's relatively intuitive because it's all capital letters. It goes AAA, AAA, and then BBB. BBB minus is the absolute floor. It is the cutoff. Anything BB plus or lower is officially considered speculative, high yield, or jank.
Moody's is a bit more visually confusing. They mix upper and lowercase letters. It goes AAA, BA. The cutoff line for Moody's is BA3. Anything BA1 or lower is junk.
So S&P is BBB minus, Moody's is BA3. You just have to commit those two specific lines to memory. If Dan buys a BB plus bond, he might think it sounds okay, but he's officially swimming in the junk pool.
Now let's talk about credit spreads. This is a vital macroeconomic indicator. A credit spread is simply the difference in yield between a corporate bond and a U.S. Treasury bond of the exact same maturity.
We use treasuries as the baseline because they are considered risk-free when it comes to default. The U.S. government can theoretically just print money to pay its debts. A corporation cannot.
So if a 10-year treasury is yielding 3% and a 10-year corporate bond from Ford is yielding 5%, the credit spread is 2%. That 2% gap is the risk premium. It is the extra financial compensation investors are demanding to take on the risk that Ford might go bankrupt and default over the next decade.
And this spread is not static. It acts like a highly sensitive thermometer for the entire economy. It widens and narrows based on aggregate investor psychology.
Let's trace this through the economic cycles. In good times, a roaring economic expansion companies are making money hand over fist. Profits are up. Nobody thinks anyone is going to go bankrupt. Investors feel incredibly confident. So what happens to the credit spread? It narrows.
Because investors don't feel they need as much compensation for risk because the perceived risk in the market is incredibly low.
Okay, wait, I want to push back on this logically to make sure I understand. Are you saying that when the economy is good, the exact same risky, highly leveraged bond suddenly gets priced as if it's less risky just because people are in a good mood?
Mm-hmm.
The underlying company hasn't necessarily changed its debt structure.
That is exactly what happens. Human psychology and herd mentality drive financial markets. When corporate profits are soaring across the board, investors become complacent. They start chasing yield. They aggressively bid up the prices of corporate bonds, which mathematically drives their yields down closer and closer to the safe treasury yields. The gap shrinks. The spread narrows.
I picture it like a sunny day at sea. Everyone thinks the boat is totally unsinkable, so they stop demanding life jackets. They accept a much lower yield because they don't perceive the danger. But then a storm rolls in, a recession hits.
The psychology flips instantly. Fear takes over the market.
Exactly. Earnings drop. Suddenly, that highly leveraged corporation looks incredibly shaky. Investors panic. They frantically sell their corporate bonds and rush their money to the absolute safety of U.S. treasuries. This massive flight to quality drives treasury prices through the roof, pushing their yields down. Simultaneously, it causes corporate bond prices to plummet, pushing their yields into the stratosphere.
And as a direct mathematical result of those two diverging movements, the gap between them, the credit spread, widens dramatically.
So the absolute rule for the exam, economic expansion. Confidence is high, spreads narrow. Recession. Fear is high, spreads widen. Just think of the life jackets on a sinking ship. The price of a life jacket goes way up during a storm.
It's a perfect visual representation. Now, if you step back, we have looked at a massive number of moving parts today. We've looked at Helen's tax rates, Carl's duration and maturity risks, callable ceilings, credit ratings, and economic spreads. It is a chaotic landscape. How does a professional investor synthesize all of this?
That brings us to our final major concept, the ultimate price tag. How do we take all this chaos, all these disparate risks, and put a single mathematically sound price tag on a bond to know if it's actually a good deal in the open market? We use a model called discounted cash flow, or DCF.
DCF is the fundamental, foundational method for determining a bond's intrinsic value. It is the complex math operating behind the curtain of the bond market.
Let's explain how it works conceptually, without getting bogged down in the algebra. DCF calculates the present value of all future cash flows using a specific discount rate. Let's break that down into plain English. A bond gives you two types of cash flows in the future: your steady little coupon payments along the way, and your massive par value repayment at the very end.
But a fundamental rule of finance is that a dollar you receive in 10 years is not worth the same as a dollar sitting in your hand today. It is worth less. This is due to the erosive power of inflation and the opportunity cost of not being able to invest that dollar today. This concept is the time value of money.
So we can't just add up all the future payments. We have to take those future cash flows and mathematically discount them, shrink them down back to today's present value. We shrink them based on an interest rate. And that discount rate is the investor's required yield. It's the number you arrive at after asking yourself, based on the inflation rate, the default risk, the liquidity risk, and the duration. What percentage do I absolutely demand to earn to make this bond worth my time?
If you run that complex math, which thankfully the Series 66 does not require you to calculate by hand on a notepad, you arrive at a single dollar figure, the DCF value. This is the bond's true intrinsic theoretical worth based entirely on your specific required return.
So let's talk about how to actually answer the exam questions using the decision rule. Think of it like shopping for bonds. You run the math, you have the DCF value in your head, and then you walk into the bond market and look at the actual price tag hanging on the bond.
If the DCF value you calculated is greater than the market price on the tag, the bond is fundamentally undervalued.
Right. Your math says the bond is intrinsically worth $950. You walk into the market and some panicked investor is selling it for $900. It's on sale. You are getting $950 of value for only $900. What is your action? You buy it aggressively.
Conversely, if the DCF value is less than the market price, the bond is overvalued.
Your math says, based on the risks, it's only worth $800, but the market is trying to charge you $900 for it. It's a ripoff. You are overpaying for the cash flows. What is your action? You avoid it entirely, or if you already own it, you sell it immediately.
Let's lock this in with a direct scenario.
Right. You sit down at the testing center. The question states that the DCF model says a bond is intrinsically worth $950. The current market is pricing that bond at $900. What is the correct investment action?
Think about it, listener.
You buy it. It's undervalued. The intrinsic value is higher than the asking price. You are getting a mathematical deal.
And that elegantly ties everything together.
Yeah.
DCF is the ultimate final expression of bond valuation. Because that discount rate you use in the formula isn't just a random number. It is derived from everything else we talked about today. You adjust that rate upward based on Dan's liquidity risk. You adjust it based on Carl's duration risk. You adjust it based on Helen's tax status. Every single variable feeds into that final price tag.
That is incredible. Okay, we have covered massive ground today. We have deconstructed the entire fixed income landscape. We are at the outro, which means it's time for the rapid fire recap. These are the top high yield testable takeaways for you to review on your walk into the exam center.
Let's run through them sequentially.
Number one, municipal bonds are federally tax exempt, but capital gains on those bonds are absolutely still taxed. And never ever put a municipal bond in an IRA or a tax sheltered account. You completely destroy the tax benefit.
Number two, debentures are simply unsecured corporate debt. They have no collateral. Secured bonds always get paid first in a bankruptcy liquidation.
Number three, negative convexity is the artificial ceiling that stops a callable bond's price from rising when interest rates plummet because the market knows the issuer is going to call it back.
Number four, duration equals maturity for zero coupon bonds. For any bond that pays a coupon, duration is always mathematically shorter than its stated maturity.
Number five, the yield seesaw for discount bonds. Coupon rate is the lowest, then current yield, then yield to maturity is the highest. For premium bonds, the order is exactly the reverse, with yield to maturity sitting at the bottom.
Number six, credit spreads widen during recessions when fear is high, and they narrow during economic expansions when investor confidence is high.
And number seven, if the calculated DCF value is mathematically greater than the market price, the bond is undervalued. It's on sale. You BUY it.
That's the list.
Wow. Okay. That is a full brain workout. Before we sign off, I'm going to throw it over to you for a final provocative thought. Leave the listener with a puzzle to chew on as they study.
I'd love to. We spent a lot of time today talking about yield to maturity, or YTM, as the ultimate comprehensive yield measure. It's often treated as the absolute gold standard in fixed income. But I want you to think critically about the core foundational assumption built into the YTM calculation. It assumes you can realistically reinvest every single coupon payment you receive over the next 10, 20, or 30 years at that exact same YTM rate. But in the real world, interest rates change constantly. They go up, they go down. So the puzzle is this. Is YTM actually a mathematical illusion? If reinvestment rates fall over the next decade, your actual realized yield at the end of the bond's life will be significantly lower than the pristine YTM printed on the prospectus today. Think about how that fundamental unavoidable flaw changes the way you view the ironclad promise of a 30-year bond.
That is deeply fascinating. The gold standard of bond measurement might just be a mirage if you aren't paying attention to the broader rate environment. A muddy diagnostic landscape indeed. Keep studying. Trust the mechanics over the memorization, and we'll see you on the next deep dive.